It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Welcome back, everyone, to 1001 Heroes, Legends, Histories, and Mysteries podcast. This is your host, John Hagedorn, and it's great to be with you today. Today we're going to put you behind the controls of a B-24 Liberator, one of thousands built by the U.S. for the purpose of delivering bombs to German factories which were producing weapons built to advance Hitler's goals to dominate all of Europe. It's the winter of 1944, and Charles Stanley and his crew are on yet another bombing run, knowing that with each mission, their chances of survival are growing dimmer. During World War II, the U.S. 8th Air Force lost over 26,000 men on these bombing runs. An additional 28,000 survived bailing out or crash landing, becoming prisoners of war. 10,561 planes were shot down by the Germans. The average number of missions flown before being blasted out of the sky was 14. Their final flight was their 13th flight. Today you'll meet author and historian Chuck Stanley, the son of pilot Charles Stanley, who has put together one of the most engrossing stories of World War II that I've ever read, an escape story that involved his father and 17 fellow airmen who were shot down and trapped behind enemy lines in Yugoslavia. Their only path of escape? The blizzard-swept Dinaric Alps, which separate the Balkan Peninsula from the Adriatic Sea. Other downed bomber crews enter the story as well, and each has their own unique story as well. But it's much more than a story of survival and escape. It's a story of the American spirit. The girl back home. The young men who went to war and in many cases never came back. The desperate plight of the ravaged people of Eastern Europe. The sacrifices of peasants who risked their lives to save American crews. The role that the underground and British agents played in helping downed airmen escape. And the toll that World War II exacted upon millions of people. It's a powerful reminder of the sacrifice it has taken to preserve freedom in much of the world today. Today's book, Lost Airmen, the Epic Rescue of World War II U.S. Bomber Crews Stranded Behind Enemy Lines. Chuck Stanley, it's great to have you with us today. What a great book. This was a real page-turner. I've enjoyed it all completely. It's amazing the story that you've done and the amount of research that you've done. Tell us a little bit about yourself, and then tell us about the Lost Airmen. Who were they, and how did you discover their story?
Well, I when I first discovered the story, I was still working. I was a civil servant for New York State. And we discovered the story when we first started reading, we meaning my brothers and I, when we started reading the letters my parents sent back and forth to each other during World War II. And we discovered there was a pretty good story in there, and decided we would learn more about what had happened during the war, and it just sort of took off.
What sort of research did you conduct, and how long did it take you to put this book together?
Well, the first thing we did was track down my father's crewmates, pretty soon it evolved into discovering the story of what happened in Yugoslavia. See, my father was shot down twice. For most of my childhood, I thought the first time was the real adventure, where he bailed out over Romania. And there's kind of an interesting story there. But it turned out that the second bailout was even more interesting. And we started tracking down the other airmen who had been downed about the same time and ended up in this town in Bosnia called Sanski Most.
I'd like you to start with the human interest side of this story. The girl back home and the family. What kind of family did your dad come from, and who was the girl back home?
Well, the my father's background was that his father was the head of a natural gas pump station in Nowhere, Pennsylvania, about 50 miles north of Pittsburgh. And luckily, that family was pretty much untouched by the Great Depression because everybody needs natural gas. He met my mother, my father met my mother in Buffalo while he was training. They started seeing each other, and but he only stayed in Buffalo for about a month, and the rest of their courtship was by correspondence. So I get to read basically everything they said to each other for 2.5 years when I look at those letters.
What swayed him to join the Army Air Force?
He wasn't a real physical guy in like the sort of football player sense. He was a smart guy. And he didn't want to spend the war camping in tents and slogging through mud. He decided he would go for the sort of the highest status specialty that he could, which was being a pilot. I think people today don't realize how new aviation was in those days and what a glory job it was to be a pilot. This is only 15 years after Lindbergh had crossed the Atlantic, and people were still setting air speed records and become famous in newspapers and magazines and radio. So it was quite a big deal to be a pilot in those days, and that's what every boy grew up wanting to be.
You had a lot of interesting anecdotes in the story. One I thought was interesting, these guys went through a lot of training, and they were pretty well culled out in terms of their skills. They wanted, if the guy was going to be sitting in the pilot seat, there were a lot of reasons he was going to be there, even compared with his co-pilot. He had to be a leader, and he had to be a guy that they knew would come through in some pretty stressful conditions. I was interested in one of the stories about their parachute jump training. None of them ever, I don't think, wanted to bail out of a plane, and they wanted to get it up there, get their job done, and get back home. The parachute jump trainer at that point was a woman, and they did not do any, but she did one and landed in a swamp and almost drowned.
Yeah, I tried to get all of these little aspects of the war into the story, and one of the important aspects of the war, I think, that's often forgotten is the role of women. And women did all sorts of non-combat yep. things, including this parachute training. So this poor woman who ended up in the swamp was apparently expendable. You know, they had spent, you know, they spent 18 months training these pilots. They couldn't have them practice bail out and turn an ankle or break a leg. They were too valuable. So they sent the poor woman up to bail out instead. And I'll just throw it. I forget if this is in the book, but the women who pilots who flew the target planes were all women. So when the gunners went up there and were practice shooting at targets that were trailing airplanes, it was women who were driving them. So apparently they were expendable too. So they played an very important part in the role. And we'll see when we get to Yugoslavia, they played an extremely important part in the underground. Maybe 20% of the partisan army were women, and some of them were fighting women.
When he finally got his wings and headed overseas, what was the first destination?
Well, he was actually pretty lucky. He took a convoy to Great Britain, and then was shipped over in a decent boat, not a Liberty boat, but a commandeered French passenger liner. So he actually went in relative comfort compared to a lot of people. But he went by boat. Some of the guys actually ferried planes over, which actually was probably preferable. But he took a ship.
So they were flying out of a base in London then before they went to Italy, right?
No. They went through a town called Newquay, which is in the western part of England. And but they did make a stop in London while they were on leave. There they got to experience the Blitz, and the worst of it was over, but the Germans were still throwing random rockets over. And my father and his crew heard the explosion of one of those rockets while they were in London.
Their next destination, if I'm correct, was Italy. Is that correct? At an air base there?
Yes.
What was the situation on the ground, and what was their military objective?
Well, the situation on the ground in Italy is that by then Italy had surrendered, and there was sort of a stagmired front in northern Italy. But for the purpose of this story, what matters is that the Army Air Forces decided that they wanted to station the 15th Air Force in southern Italy for a number of reasons. One reason was that they thought that they'd get better weather in, quote, sunny Italy than out of Great Britain. That turned out not to be so. But probably the more important reason was that Albert Speer, you know, the Führer's armaments czar, had placed oil refineries outside of the reach of the 8th Air Force flying out of Great Britain, so that most of the Reich's oil supplies at that time were in Silesia, which is modern Poland. So they only the 15th could reach them. And so their main targets were oil targets. Sometimes they attacked communications targets, which we would call transportation targets these days, you know, blocking trains that were supplying the Germans on the Eastern Front.
How dangerous were the friendly skies at that time over Yugoslavia and the other lands that they had to cross in order to get their bombing missions completed?
One of the interesting facets that I discovered, which is that, you know, I interviewed 40 airmen. Every now and then I'd slip and say, well, you got shot down over Yugoslavia, and they'd invariably correct me. They didn't get shot down over Yugoslavia. They got shot up over Germany and bailed out over Yugoslavia.
Right.
So often what would happen is they'd be flying from southern Italy, and if you draw a line almost straight north from southern Italy, from their bases to modern-day southern Poland, they cross the line crosses Yugoslavia. So they'd most of them were hitting oil targets, as I said, got shot up and could only make it to Yugoslavia. If they tried to cross the Adriatic, you know, which is the sea between Italy and Yugoslavia, and failed, that would be the end of them. The B-24 did not ditch, as they called it, in water very well, and they did not want to do that. So a lot of them chose to bail out over what was known as partisan held territory, rather than attempt it, because it was basically suicide if you tried to crash land in water in those days.
It wasn't uncommon for them to get pretty well shot up on missions.
Not at all. And it wasn't uncommon to have mechanical failures. Some of these crews weren't shot down at all. Their planes failed, and the mechanics of the time were famously competent and worked hard and adopted these planes and knew that the airmen's lives were in the mechanics' hands. But still, these things. They ran these planes till they died, basically. And by the end of the war, there were two crews for every plane. So they just ran the planes till they were called war wearies and just wore out. And there was no avoiding some of this.
Yeah, your description of the flak bursts, of the flak that the Germans' anti-aircraft guns would send up, is really incredible. You're talking about maybe 250 shrapnel pieces of steel were fly through the shell of that plane if it were within 200 yards of a flak burst. Pretty dangerous stuff. When it could take out fuel tanks, it could take out men inside. That was wicked stuff.
That was wicked stuff, and you raise another good point. I think when most people think of the air war, they think of 12 O'Clock High or the movies that are about the 8th Air Force. And in the early days of the war, there were both fighters and, you know, on the way back and forth to the target and flak over the target. And they didn't dare go face a formation in force. What they would do is let the planes get to their targets, let the flak do its job, and then try to pick off stragglers, because that's all the resources they had at the time to fight back.
This was late 44. Are we around September of 1944 now? We still haven't been shot down over Romania. That's to come here.
Right. Yeah, my father arrives in early September 1944.
And what was the situation with the German Luftwaffe? Were they pretty much getting thin by that time?
They were definitely thin by that time, and unlike American pilots, who were, you know, the casualty rates were so high that you had to offer them some hope of survival. And so we hear about the Memphis Belle, which was the first B-17 to complete 25 missions. But even at the time my father was flying, they had lifted it to 35 missions. But the Luftwaffe pilots flew till they died. I mean, there was no end for them.
Yeah.
And pilots, you know, pilots were important resources. It took the Americans 18 months to train a pilot, and you know, the Germans didn't have 18 months. If they got fresh pilots, they sent them up there pretty cold.
Let's go through Romania in terms of the first time they got shot down. What number mission was that for them, and what happened?
I think that was around 10.
Okay.
Something like that. But they go to this target called Black Hammer. There are really two Black Hammers, Black Hammer North and Black Hammer South. And together they comprise the largest complex, oil refining complex in Germany. But when I say oil refining, I don't mean like a modern oil refinery. What I mean is that it was a plant where the Germans were converting coal into synthetic fuel. So by that time, as we know today from the modern European crisis and Ukraine, that Germany doesn't have its own oil. So earlier in the war, Romania was its ally, and they got their oil from the Romanians. By now, the Russians have overrun Ploesti, have liberated a couple thousand American POWs who had been held by the Romanians because they had been bombing Ploesti. And the Germans had lost that oil supply. So these synthetic fuel plants were everything to the Germans. And without them, they couldn't run their airplanes and they couldn't run their tanks. So anyway, my father goes up there. He gets shot up again. He makes a decision that I think may be unique in the war. I've read the stories of thousands of 15th Air Force pilots who were shot up in this territory. And he's the only one who decided to go to Romania rather than go just across the border to Poland or try to get back to Yugoslavia and Italy. And he didn't want to go to Poland for a number of reasons. The Warsaw Uprising had just happened. It left a bad taste in his mouth. Russian pilots flew drunk and they weren't instructed in the difference between an American plane and a German plane, and they were just as likely to shoot you down as welcome you. And as I said, going back across the Adriatic had its own risks. So 99% of the pilots just crossed into Poland and took their chances. He went to Romania because he knew that there was an American mission in Bucharest that was repatriating these former POWs. He had seen some of these guys return to his base after they were liberated. So he knew they were there. So he took a shot, and he just... He was right, but he was just barely right. He was just a couple miles past the Eastern Front when his engines gave out, and he was forced to bail out from under 500 feet.
That was a tense moment that you wrote about. Was his co-pilot at that time named Pleasance?
Yes.
And I think Pleasance at first didn't want him to try Romania. Pleasance had other ideas. And he also, as I recall, there was a heck of a cloud base that they were on top of, and they could not see well. And this drop, if they were gonna parachute, it had to be exact, because the only place where they could take him in Romania was a pretty tight little area, and they couldn't really. They had a really good guy in there who was approximating their location.
Yes,
and I think it was thanks to his skills that they ended up surviving that.
Yes, my father had an exceptional navigator. I'm glad you brought that up, because the role of the navigator is probably underappreciated. They. You know, they didn't have satellites back then, so they operated by what was called dead reckoning, which was sort of mm-hmm. a mixture of science and art, and you couldn't just fly in a straight line either, because if you did, you'd end up over a city, and likely over flak installations. So you had to dodge cities, get to where you're going, you know, go off course, get back on course, and end up where you needed to be, and it was really tricky stuff, and yeah, Leo Cohn was an exceptional navigator.
Cohn, yeah. as it turned out, of course, the pilot and the co-pilot were the last to go, and they dang near didn't jump in time, but as it turned out.
That's right. Plaisance was convinced that my father was dead because he bailed out from such a low level, and he couldn't imagine how my father had survived the plane crash that had happened immediately after Plaisance jumped. But he did, and he did it by basically pulling the ripcord as he was leaping from the bomb bay. In other words, he was still in the plane when he yanked that cord. Otherwise, he wouldn't, and which, of course, risked being hung up on the plane.
Right.
So it was a darn near thing. And in fact, my mother regarded his survival as they were religious people. My mother regarded his survival as a miracle. And if a miracle is something that is the result of something that's extremely improbable, it was a miracle. Because he should not have survived that jump. And in fact, there's a theory that it was actually the crash of the plane and the flames, or the heat from the flames of the crash, that caught his parachute and saved his life.
So explain Romania and how he got out.
Yeah, at the time the Russians were advancing through there. My father, Romania had been an Axis ally, so my father wasn't sure what he was going to get when he ended up with Romanian civilians. But the people were very friendly to him, very very good to him. And Romania was a relatively prosperous country compared to Yugoslavia later. And he ended up being treated very well by the local population. I have photos of them in the book, I think, and on my website, because he was with upper middle class people, a doctor, the mayor of the town, and all that. And they ended up being transported to Bucharest, which was probably, 150, 200 miles away, partially by truck and partially by one of these German tri-motor aircraft, Ju-52, and ended up in Bucharest exactly as he had planned.
And of course, the yellow envelope was delivered back home, saying he was lost at that time. Is that correct? So that created a lot of fear.
Indeed, and actually, I don't want to give the impression that this is just about my father. This is, my father is a good part of the story, but it's not just because he's my father. It's because his story exemplifies what happened to all of them. His training, his and his being missing in action. So, and he's so well documented because I've got those 1,200 letters. So the reader knows that each one of these families got a similar telegram, and each of those families took the blow of learning that their son was missing in action.
Yeah, and I will also let the readers know that. In the middle chapters of this book, you do justice to a lot of the other crews who were downed at the same time that they were, and you go into detail on who some of these guys were and what their experiences were and how and if they got out. So you're right. You're not just focusing on your dad here. You're trying to – there's a lot of courage and a lot of men and a lot of families being affected by all this, obviously. But you do a good job highlighting it all and researching it all.
Thank you. I tried to cover every aspect, not just women, but POWs. And each chapter has a theme. With my father, it's basically not just the adventure, but the training. So everybody knows mm-hmm. what kind of training they went through. Sort of like Band of Brothers. You start Band of Brothers with the training, which is an important aspect of their story. It shows you how they were selected, how selective it was, and so on. But, each crew has... As their story, a lot of them is about the stress of combat and that unique form of experiencing combat by flying through fields of flak and just having to sit there and take it, not being able to fight back, not being able to hide, not being able to do anything to affect the outcome. You just had to pray and hope that one of those things didn't hit you. I don't think there's been anything like it before or since.
How long did it take your dad from the time he was shot down in Romania until he was flying missions again?
Well, they sent him to Capri for a rest camp. Rest camps were important both in England and in Italy. They the Air Force had a very modern take on courage. Unlike the British, where breaking down in combat was considered moral cowardice and a failure of character, the Americans had, I think, an enlightened view of courage, that basically courage was like money, and that you spend a little bit on each mission, and the only way to replenish your wallet was to go on a break every now and then. So at least once, midway through their tours, each of these crews was given a week off, and they went to Capri or Naples or Rome. I even know of one crew that went to Egypt. Hmm. Rest was important to these guys.
Your dad's flying again. When did they get shot down the second time?
Right. He flies a couple missions in November. And there's some pretty interesting missions there, in my view. The one mission, he gets separated from his bomb group in a that breaks up in a massive bank of clouds, and so he's alone in the skies over Germany. I think the target was Munich, and he ends up close to Berchtesgaden, for a split second, he mulls.
Hitler's bombing
Hitler's home, but he decides he'd better not, because A, he shouldn't do that without permission, and B, I don't know if this occurred to him, but it was really heavily defended. That would have been a really bad idea if he'd attempted that. So instead, they found a little railroad junction and dropped their bombs and just skedaddled home. But it's just kind of funny that, to me anyway, that he sort of had that opportunity and passed it up.
Probably a good thing.
But then he gets sent back to the same target, Blackhammer, on December 2nd, and gets shot up again, loses two engines again. The opposite two this time, but it's still the same problem of trying to fly a propeller plane with all the thrust coming from one side of the airplane. And they took turns, the him and the co-pilot. But this time, this is 6 weeks later, and by now the Air Force has a better idea of what areas in Yugoslavia are held by the partisans. So it's a better bet to head in that direction. So my father heads in that direction, gets to an area. He's still got 5,000 feet of altitude, and he talks to his navigator, and the navigator says, okay, it's time to jump. And my father says, basically, can't we get closer to the coast anyway? We're still 120 miles from the coast. Can we walk a little less? And he says, no, we know the partisans are here. So, and we got lots of altitude. Remember what happened last time. So let's jump while we have a lot of altitude. And it was a good thing that they did use that. They did have that altitude because, these parachutes were not all that reliable. Sometimes they didn't open on the first yank, and you needed every foot of it when you bailed out in those. And there were no reserve packs in those days.
So, now, did he have any of the original crew members with him at this point?
Plaisance had been injured on landing in Romania, number one. And number two, he had contracted amoebic dysentery right. From the food. So he was not ready to fly yet, and so he had a new co-pilot, but the rest of the guys were still with him.
Now they're flying, and they get hit with flak. They bail out at 15,000. They bail out at 5,000 feet. Correct.
Yeah. Yep.
And what happened from that point on?
And they land. They get collected by partisans, and Leo Cohn was right. It was the right place to jump, and they're just. 15-20 miles from this important gathering point in northern central Bosnia, a town called Sanski Most. And they get guided to this gathering point by the partisans, but end up getting stranded there. And as time goes on, all these other crews, I read about 13 crews at least parts of which end up in this town.
What was the role of the British secret agents in this story?
About mid-December, the partisans, are treating them well, but nobody seems to be doing anything about trying to get them out. So they send a message through the partisans to British agents who are not far by those standards, say 50 miles in either direction. And three British agents show up, two from the north and one from the south, and, to help coordinate the rescue of these guys. There was a pastor outside of town. The reason they picked Sanski Most as a gathering point is A, it was relatively safe, and B, it was one of the few flat areas in Bosnia at the time. Well, still, obviously. I've flown over Bosnia. Bosnia looks roughly like the Adirondacks in New York State, if your listeners have visited there. So it's not the Rockies, but it's uh-huh. pretty rugged, and there's not a lot of flat areas there. So to have a town that's on a you know alluvial plain was rare, and a rare opportunity to get planes in to rescue these guys. And why couldn't they walk to the coast? It's because they were surrounded by Germans. The Germans were retreating out of Greece, and in fact, the Americans were trying to cut them off. They didn't want them to retreat. They wanted them to surrender in Greece or Yugoslavia. So, but the Germans were all over, and there wasn't great intelligence on where they were. So it was pretty dangerous to try to walk out to the coast. Although attempts are made about a month later to walk to the coast.
How did the airmen get along with the partisans and the Yugoslavian people in general? And how did they get past the language barrier?
Well, they actually got along great in the beginning. The Yugoslavians loved Americans. They loved Americans particularly because the Americans had helped Tito escape a raid that the Germans had staged on his headquarters in Drvar. Mm-hmm. But also because they knew the Americans had no territorial designs in Yugoslavia. They knew the Americans weren't going to colonize or take over Yugoslavia, whereas the British wanted to use it as a sphere of influence. So, they loved Americans. How did they get
everybody distrusted the British
right.
from Africa
right.
through
right.
Europe?
And remember, the British are fighting the Greek communists at the same time. And the partisans are communists. So, you know, what's to stop the British from turning on their former allies for their own interests? And so they were wary. But how did they get past the language barrier? There were a few Yugoslavians who spoke English. And in fact, it's kind of interesting, I think, as you go through the book, that each of these crews, when they end up on the ground, or most of them, bumped into people who spoke English in the middle of nowhere in Yugoslavia. And it's because so many of the Yugoslavians had crossed the Atlantic, worked in Detroit or some other major industrial center for some years, making what to them was a fortune, and then decided to go home to retire. So
it's like present day Ukraine.
Yeah, right, right. And that had happened before World War I, so there were a fair number of English speakers, although not in this, not particularly in this town. But it's really funny how well over half the crews are just forest, and they walk into a cabin in the middle of Yugoslavia, and there's an English speaker there. It's funny. But the other interesting thing is we are a nation of immigrants, especially then, and or especially then anyway, in terms of immigrants from countries with languages that would be useful there. A lot of Yugoslavians spoke Italian, and Italy's right there, and Italy has had strong interests along the Dalmatian coast. And a lot of the airmen were the sons of German immigrants, or actually there's a Czech guy, there's a Slovak guy, airmen I mean. There's a Ukrainian, there's a... a couple Polish guys. So basically, almost every crew has a foreign speaker on it, and that wouldn't happen today among like one in every 10 people speaking an Eastern European language. But it happened then, and it was close enough to Serbo-Croatian that they could get along anyway and at least communicate basic needs.
We'll return with our interview with Charles Chuck Stanley Jr., last airman. Right after these sponsor messages. And now back to Lost Airmen by Chuck Stanley. Jack, do you have any more dramatic stories from the book you'd like to share?
Well, there are dramatic stories on in the air and on the ground, so I'll give you one of each. Probably the most dramatic story in the air is that of John Wolfe, who, again, gets shot up over his target and is losing altitude over Yugoslavia. To get as far as they can in these propeller planes, he has the crew lighten the plane, and as each of these pilots did. So, you know, they're throwing their gun belts out, their flak jackets, anything that weighs anything, even the radio. A B-24 is divided in half. There's the front of the plane where the pilots and the bombardier and the navigator is, and then there's the back of the plane where basically the gunners are. And so the gunners disconnect themselves from their interphones. You know, it's a headset, much like we have today, so that they can move about the plane and do that work. So when another engine fails, Wolf realizes that they have to bail out sooner rather than later. The guys are off the intercom, and they don't hear the order. The guys in the front of the plane, except for the two pilots, bail out. But Wolf realizes that those guys in the back have not bailed out, and they get to an altitude where it's no longer safe to bail out. So he orders the co-pilot out, and then he attempts to crash land his plane basically on the side of a mountain, which is pretty much impossible. He died trying to save the lives of those three guys in the back. But again, pretty much miraculously, one of them did survive. So he actually succeeded in saving the lives of one of those three men. And later on, his navigator sought the Medal of Honor for him. But he didn't get that, but he did get the second highest medal that the country has to offer. So he's quite a hero.
Before you get to your second story, remind me which airfield it was that was one of the recommended places they could land, but it was extremely dangerous because it wasn't a long enough runway for a B-24.
Right. It's the island of Vis, which is just off the Adriatic coast, not far from the port of Split, which you can find on your maps in, I think it's modern-day Croatia.
Yeah, you did a beautiful job on that. They had a couple of very, very experienced pilots. And maybe it was a pilot and a co-pilot, or maybe it was just two pilots, two planes. They had to they had to crash land, and they had to bring it down there. They described that airfield, that planes were piled up like used cars, because once they got these big B-24s in, there wasn't enough room to take off, and a lot of them were broken up upon landing because the strip was so short, and they were cracking up as they landed them. I was hoping you could relate that story of how these guys decided, hey, man, we're not staying here. We're taking off.
Sure. There's a story in Frank Ambrose's book, The Wild Blue, about McGovern. And McGovern ended up on that island, later Senator George McGovern. And he was told by the British that you couldn't fly off that airstrip. The airstrip was about half the length of a B-24 airstrip, because it was meant for fighter planes, not for transports, not for bombers. So McGovern accepted his word, and so did Stephen Ambrose. But the fact is, you could fly off that strip if you did it right. So there's you know, that's a correction for Stephen Ambrose that I give in my book. So anyway, there were two of the pilots who ended up in Sanski Most emergency landed at that airstrip in November, and they did it the same day and during the same mission. So both these guys end up there. They the British told them, you can't take off, and both of them said, yes, I can, and they did. They had their flight engineers salvage parts from all these crashed airplanes that were on one side of the airstrip, and repaired their planes, got just enough fuel to get back to Italy, and gunned their engines like race cars, in a drag.
And kept the pressure on the brakes. They're juicing the engines while they're holding
just
the brake.
Just like a drag race, and managed to take off. And David Blood, who we'll meet later on, decided he would show those limeys a thing or two, and went back and buzzed the flight tower. Close means fly as close to the ground as you can without, and you know, so that everybody has to duck. So that was forbidden, of course, but he did it anyway. He was a wild character.
Yeah, there were some wild guys all over World War II in different places at different times.
Indeed, and blood's mine.
The Solomons, some of those pilots around there too, some of the stories from there, it just cracked me up.
Yeah.
Like the guys going up in shorts with a couple of handheld bombs and flying low enough over the Japanese base on their surprise attacks that they're just chucking them out of the cockpit.
Oh yeah.
What's your second story? You had a good dramatic story you said you were going to share. You had one land and one.
Sure. So there comes a point where the airmen are no longer welcome. The townspeople love them, but after a time, the airmen wear their welcome out. There are a lot of them. They're conspicuously wealthy. They all have 48 gold-backed American dollars in their escape kits, or most of them. They don't understand the exchange rates. They're paying too much for the scarce resources that are in the town, and they're basically blocking the regular folk out of the marketplace, because naturally the merchants want to sell their goods to the rich Americans. And beyond that, there's there are a few cultural things, and these are communists, remember, and there's a lot of inequity that these Americans are rich and consuming everything. It's against the partisan code. So anyway, after a while, the partisans have had enough, and they want to send the Americans out, and they have they try to send them to the coast, as I alluded to earlier. The attempt fails, and everybody has to turn back. So these at least 60 of the 80 some Americans who were in town had gone on this journey, ran into a blizzard, turned around, and came back. Eventually, three airplanes are dispatched from Italy on the request of these British agents, and then there's a story about how 18 of them had to remain behind, and my father volunteers to be one of these 18 men because the transports say there isn't enough room on the planes. But then the 18 are forced to walk out, and that's where the drama happens, because they ran into that same not same blizzard, but the same conditions, and end up stuck in a cabin that was probably a logger's cabin, again in nowhere, and they run out of food and they run out of fuel, and another blizzard comes, and there's 6 feet of snow outside, and the snow becomes so deep that they have to dig out the windows so that they don't suffocate. Two of the partisans who are with them decide that they have to go on. There's an officer who is carrying dispatches and an aide, and for whatever reason, he decides he has to press on, and so they go out into the storm. And maybe a day later, the aide comes back because they couldn't make it, and they later found the body of the officer frozen to death. But when this aide comes back, he's got a frostbitten foot; he can't walk. And they reach a point that they just have they meaning the airmen and the partisan escorts that they just have to go. They can't stay there. They'll freeze to death. They're starved to death. And they just have to try to go, as dangerous as it is. But they can't carry this guy, so they just left him to meet his fate. I'd call that pretty dramatic.
Some of the airmen you write about were captured. How were the POWs treated by the Germans?
Well, yes, they generally speaking, the captured men were treated well. But if you were caught by the SS, they just shoot you. So you. It's an odd thing to think of in modern times, because in the movies they show that, you know, Americans are trying to elude capture and all that. But in fact, they were instructed, at least in the 15th Air Force, if you were shot down over Germany, find an authority that's non-SS and surrender. Find a Luftwaffe officer, find a policeman, find somebody. Because if the civilians caught you, they'd kill you. And if the SS caught you, they'd kill you. And where are you going to go? You're in the middle of Germany. Two of the people I write about are found by SS officers and just plain shot. But the guys who were captured were treated respectfully. but I can't say well, because the Germans themselves were starving, and they didn't have a lot of resources to give to their to the American POWs or the British POWs, and it was really the Red Cross that kept these POWs alive with the famous Red Cross packages, and sustained them while they were in these camps. As time went on, the Russians are advancing and preparing to liberate the camps. The Germans would evacuate the Stalags rather than let the Americans fall into the Russians' hands. There's a famous episode called the Black March, where a POW camp was evacuated, and the POWs had to march across Germany under starvation conditions in the middle of winter without resources, and basically scrounging along the way. And again, nobody bothers to, or at least few of them, bothered to try to escape. There was nowhere to go. Yeah. And if they were caught by civilians, they would be killed. So they were better off with their guards. So yes, I would say the Germans actually did the best they could, but it wasn't very good.
What were the final days when your father and his crew were able to get out and get the freedom? How did that happen? How did it go down?
Well, they after they left this cabin I told you about, there was they still had half the distance to go to the Adriatic, but they would walk from basically encampment to encampment with the underground, and finally ended up in what we would consider to be civilization, and reached Scene and Split, and there was a mission at Split. Manned by the OSS, and they were transported by a British crash boat, which is their equivalent of a PT boat, and taken to Bees, and from there they were transported by C-47 to Italy.
And did he try to fly again after that?
He was prepared to have to fly again. He didn't realize that he would be sent home. And in fact, I was the one who informed him how he got, or why he was sent home. He never did understand it. All of a sudden, they told him, "You're going home." And he said, "Okay." Hmm. But it turned out that it was, there was a rule that if you were missing for 42 days in enemy territory, that was a ticket home.
Wow, okay.
He'd been gone 42 days. And in fact, there's a sad story about one of the guys he walked out with, John Mulvaney, who was only missing for 40 days, went back into combat and was later killed in action.
Oh, God.
So, that 42 days was important.
So there was a marriage due once he got back to the States. How did that all go down?
Yeah. So my parents had been engaged during training. And again, the proposal was by letter, and the acceptance was by letter. He gets shot down once, and the first time, and my mother writes to him and says, basically, couldn't you have brought your parachute back? There's no material here in the States for wedding dresses, and apparently it was a fad at the time, where that if you could get if you got shot down, or you're a paratrooper, you could get your hands on a parachute that people were making wedding dresses out of the nylon in parachutes. They talked about hitting the silk, but it wasn't silk after Japan attacked us, because the silk was coming from Japan. It was newly invented nylon, and it was scarce. Everything was going into war production. So my father joked that he had to get shot down the second time to get the parachute, and he carried that parachute all the way across Yugoslavia. The parachute was was the only blanket he had, basically, as he slept in those cabins as he walked across Yugoslavia. And so it saved his life when he jumped. It saved his life while he was traveling, and then his bride got married in it.
What happened with some of the other airmen after the war ended?
They, they're a mixed bag, like any group of people. Some of them suffered from post-traumatic stress syndrome, no doubt, and suffered with that. Some of them had been injured and had to recover from their injuries. Some of them did quite well in life, and some of them didn't. There's a a paragraph in there where I rattle off the names of maybe two dozen of these 84 men that were in town, who all died before they could collect Social Security. So you have to think mm-hmm. that the rigorous suffering that they went through had a long-term impact on their lives.
Yep, true of so many of them.
Indeed.
Are there any of the lost airmen still alive?
There are three of them still alive. I'm in contact with all three, one in Louisiana, one in Florida, and one in Massachusetts. And they're all quite sharp and just great guys to talk to.
And their names?
Oh, well, there's Powell Robinson is in near Boston, Massachusetts. Joe Foto is near New Orleans. And William Clark is in Naples, Florida.
I've got friends in Naples. Nice area.
Beautiful area.
Is there anything we can take from their experience that we can apply today?
Yeah, to me, it was all about service. You know, these men were literally servicemen. They thought of themselves as having to do a job and get back to their regular life. Some of them ended up as career officers, but I don't think any of them started off intending to be career officers. And none of them thought of themselves as heroes. None of them were self-serving. They did a job and came home. And, you know, we can call them heroes. None of the guys, I've interviewed 40 guys, none of them would call themselves heroes, none of them.
Yeah, they always tend to say it's the heroes, those are the guys we left behind.
Certainly, absolutely.
Well, we've been talking today with Chuck Stanley Jr. about his brand new book, Lost Airmen, the epic rescue of World War II U.S. bomber crews stranded behind enemy lines. Fantastic story and a great read. I recommend all of you pick it up. That's Lost Airmen by Charles E. Stanley Jr. And Chuck, thank you very much for your time today. Appreciate it and enjoyed very much this time talking with you.
Thank you.